I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. If you live or work in Baltimore, you may have been filmed by an aerial surveillance camera sometime this year. In January, a private company began flying a Cessna outfitted with high-tech cameras over Baltimore City on behalf of the police department. The program was paid for by an anonymous donor. Most of us, including members of the city council and perhaps even the mayor, learned about the program just last week when Bloomberg Businessweek published an article about it. What is this technology capable of? Who has access to its data? Why wasn't the public informed? Has Big Brother come to Baltimore? We talked to an ACLU staff attorney and the reporter who broke the story. That's Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're talking today about an aerial surveillance program the Baltimore Police Department has been using for months, unknown to the public. Since January, an Ohio-based company called Persistent Surveillance Systems has been circling the city in a Cessna airplane off and on, filming with high-tech cameras. The cameras are capable of filming a 32-square-mile area in one fell swoop. That footage is instantly archived, allowing analysts to go back in time and track the movements of individual cars and people. The system's inventor describes it as, quote, Google Earth with TiVo capability, close quote. Bloomberg Businessweek broke the news last week. The surveillance program was paid for here in Baltimore by a wealthy Texas philanthropist couple who gave $360,000. Some of the money was channeled through the nonprofit Baltimore Community Foundation. The rest went through a national nonprofit in Washington called the Police Foundation. After the news broke, many people have expressed anger that the program was kept under wraps. It appears that the Baltimore Police Department did not inform the mayor or the city council before initiating the surveillance program, let alone the public. Is this new surveillance system akin to the cameras that already film our movements? How can it be used to solve crime? And what exactly is this new eye in the sky seeing? In a few minutes, we'll hear from the reporter who broke the news and a staff attorney from the ACLU. But first, T.J. Smith, spokesman for the Baltimore Police Department, joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, of course, the first question, at least from a reporter, is why didn't the Baltimore Police Department inform the public about the surveillance program before starting it?
Well, we don't typically come out and announce any crime-fighting strategy as we go after trigger pullers in our city of Baltimore. And one thing that is being lost in this whole conversation, and I heard your open that said many are expressing outrage and frustration, many are actually applauding our efforts as well. And that's the part, unfortunately, that the media is missing. The Baltimore Sun put out a poll over the past week, which they printed in their newspaper today, that showed that 75 or 76% of the respondents said that the Baltimore Police Department shouldn't have disclosed this information to the public, and they're okay with that. And so much of the media is missing that. And what's also being missed is that we had 344 murders in the city of Baltimore last year, the worst year per capita we've ever had in the city of Baltimore. That's 344 broken families. And we've heard from those mothers, those fathers, those husbands and wives who want something done about the violence. And they say, we want you to be creative. We want you to figure it out. We don't want to hear excuses. We want you to figure it out. And they asked us to be creative. And we want to be as creative as we can within the confines of the law. And this is within the law. So the argument is not about what can this technology do to help the crime fight. It seems like the argument has become more of a media fight of why didn't we know about it, as opposed to, wow, this could actually be working. And in a second, I'll share some further information with you of some things that we've found out since that last week.
Okay, hold that thought, because I do want that information. And I certainly take your point that the ultimate judgment on this new technology should be how effective it is in crime, as well as what it does or doesn't do to privacy. But on your first point about we don't usually let people know, I mean, it seems to me you've gone step by step with the public in talking about body cameras and exactly how they were going to be tested, what the timeline was for deploying them, how people would know that they are being used. That doesn't seem to match what you're saying, that we don't usually tell people before we start a new technology.
Because that's a totally different piece of equipment that's already been tried, tested, and proven that taxpayer dollars were used, and we had a robust pilot program with that. And we were experimenting with something here to see if it would be valuable, and we had a plan to discuss this publicly. Again, it's sad because I actually heard from a mother of a murdered victim this morning who called my line just to say thank you because they saw us on Square Off discussing this yesterday. They called to say thank you. We've actually gotten a number of people who've called us to say thank you. And the frustrating part for me is that's the part that's missing from the media. It seems like this is, I mean, you can read the comments in the media section, the Baltimore Sun. You can read the comments, and most of them are asking why is it being made such a story about when we discussed it as opposed to is this going to be valuable to keep Baltimore off the map for having 344 murders and more murders per capita. Here's something that's interesting as well, Sheila, and I think this is important. Over the last 8 weeks, since July 1st, we've averaged 5.6 shooting victims per week, daytime shooting victims per week. Since this story broke last week, we've had one daytime shooting, and that was Sunday evening at about 5:30, or Saturday evening at about 5:30. The bad guys, the trigger pullers, are abreast of technology. And they're abreast of things that we use to try to go after them. And as I've said over and over again, and I will continue to say it, the people who need to be concerned about technology like this are the bad guys who want to harm our city. And we've seen it too frequently in the city of Baltimore. And I think those numbers speak for themselves, that since this news broke, one daytime shooting, when we've averaged 5.6 victims of daytime shootings per week, since July 1st, but not this past week.
You've sort of teed up for me exactly one of my concerns about your saying that we were experimenting with this, because you seem to actually, it seems to be already part of the Baltimore Police Department's procedures, and you have, if I understood you correctly at your press conference last week, you have used this in charging people. You have used the results of this surveillance. Is that correct?
No, so again, we can take some fault and people not fully understanding the technology. The technology is not an end-all, be-all. The technology in itself is absolutely worthless when not coupled with other investigative means. This is not going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back of investigation. What this gives you, again, and you mentioned it in the intro, is a retrospective look at figures. You can't tell what those figures are without further investigation. The figure could be a deer. It could be a dog running. You don't know what the figure is until you do further investigation. But what it does give you is an idea of something happened here. Now let's look in this area to see what else we can glean from evidence. And you have to put it together that way. Part of experimenting with anything, part of your trial and error process with anything is using it to see how valuable it's going to be for you. So yes, of course we've used it. Of course, if you glean something that could eventually be of evidentiary value, of course you're going to use it. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it's still a trial period. That doesn't make it an end-all, be-all. We haven't entered into any agreement to move forward with this technology. It's something that we needed to look at to see if it was technology that we want to move forward with as a city. And something else is very important. The city of New York is always on the cutting edge. They're the first to get a lot of technology across the country for homeland security purposes. There's some technology that they have up there that if somebody commits a robbery or violent crime on the street, they can, and the suspect's wearing a red shirt, they can eliminate everybody on that street who's not wearing a red shirt. And some of us here in Baltimore sit and look at that and say, man, how valuable would that be in a city like Baltimore? But somebody has to test it first, and someone has to do it first, and they did it. And we've seen this across the country. Now, Baltimore, one of the cities that's been talked about as most violent, has an opportunity to experiment with some technology that can help us get bad guys off the street, help us get trigger pullers who want to harm people on the streets of Baltimore off the street. And, again, the public, according to an unscientific poll done by the Baltimore Sun over the past week, 76% of them said the city didn't have an obligation, or the police department didn't have an obligation to share with us, and we're not mad about that. Reading the comments of the citizens in Baltimore, it's a lot of thank yous for trying something different.
Right, and I would just underscore, as you just said, that that is an unscientific poll. You said that the city is known as among the most violent. That's true. It's also, since the Justice Department report 2 weeks ago, known as a city with a police department that is not very transparent. Was the Justice Department, the Baltimore City Police Department undertook this experiment while it knew it was being investigated and judged by the U.S. Department of Justice. Was that a concern? Was that something that you took into account?
Sheila, with all due respect, we're not going to stop fighting crime while we're under the Department of Justice review. We're going to continue to fight crime, and we're not going to sit back and allow a mother or father to become childless because we're worried about what somebody else thinks. We're operating within the confines of the law, and the Justice Department was aware of this technology. So these notions that transparency, and I'm going to take personal offense to that, not to you, but to that, because we are a very transparent agency. We live stream. You don't have to send a reporter down to our police headquarters because we're live streaming press conferences for you. We live stream the Department of Justice announcement to our public in a scathing report. We live stream that from our account because we want everyone to see what's going on. We live stream the good, the bad, and the ugly. And again, we can't take one single issue and turn this into us not being a transparent agency. That's absolutely unfair, and it's not realistic. We're trying to get bad guys off the street and trying to stop those bad guys from harming people in the city of Baltimore. And they are the ones that should be grossly offended at the new technology because they know that we're doing everything in our power to come after them and to stop them from harming people in Baltimore and hold them accountable if they do.
This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. That is T.J. Smith, Baltimore police spokesman. We're talking about an aerial surveillance plane that's been capturing footage in Baltimore for months without the public's knowledge. I want to introduce the reporter who broke that story in Bloomberg Businessweek, Monty Real. He's joining us from a studio in Chicago. Monty, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure, I'm glad you could join us. And with me here in the studio is David Rocha, Senior Staff Attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you for having me on.
I'd like to get your thoughts about what we have heard from T.J. Smith of the police department.
Well, there's both a process point here and a substantive point. The process point dealing with the secrecy and substantive dealing with the privacy implications of this technology. On the process point, it's rare that I'm left speechless listening to someone, but listening to TJ, I don't know how to respond.
I do need you
to say that. He sounds exactly.
He's there.
Almost,
you can talk to him.
He sounds word for word like Martin O'Malley sounded when he was defending the mass arrest policy. To say that that this is all about going after trigger pullers.
Well, that is the crime fight.
No. Well, I mean, there's no doubt we have a murder problem in Baltimore, but they're also using it for property theft and to follow dirt bike riders, according to the article. But more importantly, you can't say that you care about transparency and accountability and then say it's irrelevant that we didn't disclose this. The idea that this wouldn't be controversial You have to be living in a fantasy land to think that, and to do this with without even the elected officials knowing, but more importantly, the people of Baltimore knowing. The fact that they do that routinely is true, but it's also a problem. We should have.
What would you like T.J. Smith to address? I mean, he has said that they think this is an important tool.
It's not a question of what he can address or not address. I mean, I think disagreements.
I have him for just a few minutes. I mean, I want to take advantage of the fact that we have someone from the police department with us. And it seems to me, I understand that you disagree with what he has said. But if there's something you want him to address, we have him for just a couple more minutes.
I don't have anything for him to address. I mean, I think he's stated his position. I'd like to offer a response because I think they're both as a process matter and as a substantive matter, this is wrong.
Your substantive objection is?
The privacy implications. So, I mean, it's important for people to understand what it is that this technology does. It creates.
And on that point, I think you're right. Let me ask you, Monty Real, can you give us in a minute or two a description of the program that you reported on?
I can try. I don't know. It's basically they went up for usually about 5 hours at a time, and it captures the 32 square mile image if the weather is good. And they have analysts on the ground, a team of usually five or six, who, whenever they're asked to investigate something, go in and they can consult those images. And generally, they track vehicles and the movements of those vehicles to and from crime scenes or individuals that show up as sort of unidentifiable dots, but that can be tracked to addresses. And they do that for a wide variety of crimes,
and can also be matched with images from the fixed cameras, the blue light cameras that Baltimoreans are familiar with. Correct.
Right. If it actually shows up on the screen, if the vehicle or the individual goes into one of the areas that a ground camera covers, it goes into a white circle, essentially. So they know that they can request that image from the police if it goes into that.
So David Rocha of the ACLU, the privacy concern is what?
This kind of mass surveillance is a privacy nightmare come to life because it means that we can never go out in public without the government tracking our movements. If we did this in the physical world, it would be the physical equivalent of the government slapping a GPS tracker on us every time we exit the door of our house. And if we did that in the physical world, it would never be tolerated, not for a moment. But because it's being done remotely by technology and we don't viscerally feel it, we can ignore and escape the privacy consequences. But the consequences are huge and vast of the government having the power to know everywhere that we go, every time that we leave our house. And that's what this technology does. The fact that it's now mounted on a Cessna is only a matter of time before it's mounted on a drone that flies 24/7. The resolution of the cameras is only going to increase, not decrease. The need for human intervention to identify who is being tracked will only decrease, not increase. So the fact that the government would then have a permanent record, which it could go back and review at any time, of any one of us, where we went, whether we attend a house of worship, whether we go, which doctor's office we go to, which political meetings we go to, which people we visit, where we work, everything, which is why in U.S. v. Jones, the Supreme Court said that in order to do that kind of persistent tracking, you need a warrant supported by individualized suspicion. But here, by definition, there's no individualized suspicion because they're putting one third of the city under surveillance at any given instant.
T.J. Smith, what do you say to those concerns?
He actually has me speechless because it was that ridiculous. I mean, that worrying about law-abiding citizens is not a concern of the Baltimore Police Department. A retrospective look, no different than the blue light cameras that are on ground level, surveillance cameras that are in and around many people's homes these days, is what we're concentrating on. We're concentrating on people who violated the law, and then using this is a piece of a puzzle. And unfortunately, a lot of people I've heard talking about this technology are people that are secluded in bubbles that live outside of the city of Baltimore, don't live in West Baltimore, haven't been touched as a victim of crime. They haven't lost a loved one. They never hear the cries of mothers who've lost their children. They're people who live in these secluded worlds, and unfortunately, they don't have to worry about our 70% non-closure rate in homicides. We need to do everything we can to increase that number, again, as long as it's lawful. And this is lawful. This is people who don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy. This has nothing to do with going inside somebody's home, following them to work or their place of business. That's conspiracy theory to put fear in people who subscribe to that, and that's totally made up. That has nothing to do with this technology and the reason that we're using it. And it's absurd, and it's almost offensive to the citizens of Baltimore who struggled through the years that we've seen, year after year after year. And as we try to do something and try to get closer to increasing our closure rate, catching bad guys who many are repeat violent offenders, and get them off the street, then that's what we're going to do. It was a news story on this kid, Kyrie Green, who we arrested here in Baltimore back in July. Baltimore County just arrested him. He committed four violent acts in a very short period of time. We got really good surveillance images on the ground of him, which helped us lead to getting him off the street. This kid went to two different high schools in Baltimore and tried to shoot young people. Fortunately, because of surveillance on the ground, we were able to get him in custody. It's technology like this that's going to allow us to get people like him off the street quicker, so we're not going to funerals. The funeral homes are backed up. The T-shirt places are backed up. The balloon companies and flower companies are backed up because we keep hashtagging names and putting RIP, and then we have people thinking it's this big conspiracy to follow law-abiding citizens. It's absolutely absurd. We're trying to track down suspects who've committed crimes in the city of Baltimore.
I know we're trespassing on your time. Let me just, since you talked about the citizens and what the citizens care about, let me just ask you to respond to this email we got from a citizen of Baltimore named Sharon, who says, while I can just barely understand the police department's decision to withhold public notification about the aerial surveillance program, how do they justify their decision to keep the mayor and other elected officials in the dark about their crime-fighting program?
Now, the people who needed to know as we move forward are always kept in the loop. And that's, again, something that's being made more of a media issue than it is an actual issue. We are always out there trying to figure out different ways and unique ways of doing something, whether it's communication, whether it's fighting crime, whether it's going out to do an interview, and we keep all of our people in the loop when we feel that it's absolutely necessary. We can't go and present something without any detail or any facts, especially when it's new and cutting edge. And that's what I go back to again. When I say we look at all of these big cities across the country that ultimately end up with this technology that's used to fight crime, and we sit back and wonder why has there been a drop so dramatically in this city and not here? And we scrutinize everything. No one's saying that we should be without the scrutiny. Of course, we're okay with that. But we're trying to continuously explain our reasoning behind it. Again, those that believe that this is a big conspiracy theory are going to believe that regardless, and it doesn't matter how we would have come out and say it. But I think Monty will be able to explain a lot more of what the view is and the vantage point is from where they are, and the understanding of what you actually glean from the technology versus what you don't glean from the technology. And again, we can absorb that responsibility, that once we show, and the Bloomberg News article showed some of it, once you show what you glean from it, I think people are going to ultimately be a lot more comfortable. But those that believe that it's a conspiracy are going to probably continue to believe that.
So you're going to continue to test this technology?
We're winding down in our test phase, and we're going to evaluate and see if this is something worthwhile that we want to move forward with in the public. And at that point, that's when we certainly will open it up for public discussion and public debate.
And that will be when?
We're winding down as the year runs out. We hope to use it in the coming months as we have some significant events going on, like the Baltimore Marathon. And we've seen, again, as we talk about trigger pullers, which are the biggest threat to the city of Baltimore, we still have to be mindful of domestic terrorism that has gone on throughout this country, unfortunately, too many times for us to count of late, and across the world. So this is a public safety tool beyond just simply trigger pullers. But this is a public safety tool in itself as well.
T.J. Smith, thank you.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
T.J. Smith is a spokesman for the Baltimore Police Department. I'm Sheila Cast. We're going to take a quick break here. We'll continue with Monty Real, whom we've barely gotten to hear from Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote the story titled "It's Not Spying If They're Always Watching," which broke last week. And with David Rocha, senior staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland, you can join this conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Small planes outfitted with wide-angle cameras flying high above Baltimore, transmitting images to analysts on the ground. This surveillance program operated on and off for months without the public's knowledge until last week. We're discussing it this hour. I'm joined by the Bloomberg Businessweek reporter Monty Real, who broke the story, and David Rocha, senior staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. David, I think your exchange with T.J. Smith sort of tees up this question. His position is that if this technology can head off crime, if it can catch people who've committed crime, isn't it worth the cost of privacy?
No, in a word. I mean, you know, this notion that I'm not denying its effectiveness. Its effectiveness is precisely what makes it terrifying. Not because I don't care about crime and, you know, his insulting line that I live in a bubble. I live in Baltimore City. I'm as...
Actually, I thought he might be referring to Monty Real. Don't take it personally.
In any event, its effectiveness isn't the question. I'm sure it's, as the article itself demonstrated, it can be very effective. But if that's your only... metric by which you judge whether a technology is acceptable, then I think you're frankly missing the point. There are things in a democratic society that we shouldn't do, even if they're effective. It would be effective to slap a GPS bracelet on me every time I walk out the door and on every human being in the country. It would be effective if the government didn't need a warrant to search my email or search my house. All those things are effective. If effectiveness is your only metric, then you are not going to have a free country. There are other things that matter in a free society. I also think it's important to say that the idea that this is a panacea to our crime problem is itself a fantasy. If this was so effective at eliminating crime, then why have murders been spiking during the trial of this technology? So it's not that it's some magic bullet that will allow us to solve crime. And this idea that we're going to that you peddle it to people by saying, if you don't let us do this, if you don't give up your privacy and freedom, you're going to die. That's the line of despots everywhere. And to hear it articulated by the spokesperson for the Baltimore City Police Department is terrifying and appalling. And to say that the citizens of Baltimore should have no knowledge or say in what kind of surveillance technologies are used on us by the police department that works for us is so insane that it's really difficult to comprehend how he can say it with a straight face.
Well, in fairness, what I heard him to be saying is that this is an experiment. Yes, it's being used to actually charge people and take evidence into court, presumably.
Well, that,
and that's something that somebody wants to talk about. Look, I do want to hear this, but I also we keep referring, Monty Real, to your reporting, which presumably not everybody who's listening to us has heard. It grew, this technology grew out of a military effort in Iraq to fight roadside bombs, correct?
That's right, yeah. Ross McNutt, who's the founder of Persistent Surveillance Systems, had worked with the Air Force Center for Rapid Product Development. He was the director of that. And in about 2004, that team was asked to try to come up with a way to detect who in Iraq was planting roadside bombs. And the team came up with this wide area imaging, motion imaging system that the system that they're using in Baltimore was based on. And it was essentially the same technology. It had fewer cameras when it started, but in 2007, the technology was deployed to Iraq and was used in Fallujah and elsewhere, eventually in Afghanistan too. And Ross McNutt at that time, 2007, 2008, left the military to commercialize it and started Persistent Surveillance Systems, basically using the same technology that the system called Angel Fire that the military used. He just adapted it for commercial use, and that's what's being used in Baltimore now.
Ross McNutt was very open in giving you access to the flights in Baltimore. He's been pretty open. He did a piece with Radiolab on public radio. Did he think that this wouldn't become public at some point? I mean, why did he give you that kind of access? Do you have any idea?
No, I think he knew it would become public at some point, and I actually thought it would become public probably before the article came out. One thing that I wanted to ask T.J. Smith was why he didn't respond or accept an interview request. I told him a week before the article came out that it was coming out, said it would be very detailed, go into how the technology works, how it's being applied in Baltimore, how it's being used, said that I had visited the offices and this would be a very detailed article and I wanted the police perspective in the article. And so the things that he was just saying on the radio, I would have loved to have that in the article, but they declined to talk. So they were keeping that, you know, to their chests right up till the end. But Ross McNutt did let me, and I had been talking to him for almost a year, probably. I had heard about the company last year, contacted him, and I was interested in the topic. I'm working on a book about the U-2 spy plane, and that's what initially piqued my interest in it. And just over the course of months, I would periodically contact him, and I knew that it was being used in a major American city. And then in June, I found out it was Baltimore. And we went there. We had, obviously, a photographer and a videographer who went as well. And I think his point of view, Ross McNutt's, was that he believes in the system and wanted as much information out when the news broke as he could possibly get. The police department had a different view, I guess.
Greg has called us from Baltimore with, I think, a legal question.
Hi, Greg. Every trial I've sat as a juror on, it often breaks down to the cops say one thing and the suspect says another thing. If the police are in possession of information which might serve to help the defense, aren't they required to disclose that to the defense? I mean, the fact that they have this information about people's movements and they haven't told the defense in any cases about it or where it came from, or that they might have something that exonerates their suspect, leads me to believe that we might have dozens of cases thrown out because of suppression of evidence.
Greg, it's a good question. Let me turn to the lawyer who's in this conversation, David Broca of the ACLU.
It's a point I wanted to make, which is that not just that there's, potentially exculpatory evidence, but that from the reporting that's been done, it's actually already been used in cases that have been charged and not disclosed. And what that does is it prevents the defense attorney from ever having an opportunity to challenge this on Fourth Amendment grounds. And in that regard, it's strikingly similar to the way law enforcement agencies around the country were using stingray technology, which is the technology that mimics cell phone towers and forces all the phones within range to connect to it to then allow the phones to be very precisely located. And that technology was, again, a battlefield technology that moved to domestic law enforcement just like this and deployed with, again, an unprecedented amount of secrecy, which prevented any judicial resolution of the significant Fourth Amendment questions involved. And here, there are very significant Fourth Amendment questions from this kind of mass surveillance. As I said, U.S. v. Jones says you can do this tracking only with an individualized warrant. But by definition, a tracking technology that puts one-third of the city under surveillance at any given moment is not individualized. It's the opposite of individualized. And the legality of that has never been adjudicated because the technology, until we learned last week, had never been deployed. But now we know it's not only been deployed, but it's actually been used in particular cases and not disclosed to the defense attorneys in those cases. That's shocking. And we should be appalled by that.
We need to take a quick break here, and when we come back, lots more about the balance between privacy and public safety. How do citizens protect themselves in an age of rapidly advancing technology? What responsibility does the state have to inform the public about forms of surveillance? You can join this conversation with a phone call to 410-662-8780 or an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with journalist Monty Real, who broke the story about Baltimore's aerial surveillance program in a piece for Bloomberg Businessweek, and with David Rocha, senior staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. We're talking about aerial surveillance of Baltimore. You can join the conversation with an email to midday@wypr.org or a phone call to 410-662-8780. Kat emailed us this question. Why is a wealthy couple from Texas funding surveillance of Baltimore City? Monty Real, you reported on that. What can you tell us?
Well, the couple is John and Laura Arnold, and John Arnold is a former hedge fund manager, and he was an Enron trader, and he retired a few years ago, a billionaire. And since then, he and his wife have started a foundation that funds lots of causes, and some of them are pretty controversial. They include things like pension fund rollbacks, charter schools. And this particular donation, though, it was they did it as private individuals. And what happened was, I believe, they heard about the program, about the company, Persistent Surveillance Systems, on the radio, on that Radio Lab show that you had referred to last year. And they were interested in it and contacted the owner of the company. And I think the offer was basically thrown out there, we will provide some money for this if you can find a city that's willing to put the technology into use. And McNutt had known some people in the Baltimore Police Department. He had done some trials here before, just not nearly as long as this one, of course. But he knew people in the police department, and his explanation was Baltimore was ready, it was willing, and it was just post-Freddie Gray. So they came back to the Arnolds and said, you know, Baltimore is willing to do this, and he John and Laura Arnold donated the money through initially the Baltimore Community Foundation. And so that's how the program got started there.
Right. And that was $120,000. And the Baltimore Community Foundation has sort of apologized for not looking more, not making more scrutiny of what that $120,000 was to be used for. But then twice that much got funneled through the Police Foundation in
right.
Washington. So about a quarter of a million, more than almost a quarter of a million dollars came through that route. Alan has called us from Baltimore. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You're definitely ACLU argues against this on both substantive and process grounds. I think substantively, I don't think anybody has a reasonable expectation of privacy from just public observation. This isn't targeted. This is a broad sweep. And from a process standpoint, I don't think the police normally telegraph their methods of investigation. Obviously, they have to, if they develop evidence against a specific subject, they would have to either exculpatory or otherwise, they'd have to disclose that. I just don't see the issue here from a privacy or from a process standpoint.
Alan, I appreciate the call. David Rocco, please answer, Alan.
From a process standpoint, I guess we would have to agree to disagree. I mean, it's true that as a matter of fact, police departments do not typically get approval to deploy new surveillance technologies. I think that's a problem. Your caller doesn't. But I think in a democratic society, the people who are being surveilled by the police ought to have a say in what kind of technologies are being used to surveil them. That seems like a basic principle of democracy to me. On the substantive point, it's true that there is lots of case law out there that says what you expose to the public, you don't have a privacy interest in. But all of those cases involved particular observations of particular people in a particular time and place.
Let me just interrupt to add something I'd like you to address.
Sure.
Commissioner Davis, Police Commissioner Davis, mm-hmm. in his statement on mm-hmm. this, referred to the deployment of the blue light cameras, mm-hmm. the fixed cameras.
Mm-hmm.
He said that the Supreme Court has ruled that there's no expectation of privacy in what those cameras surveil. Is that he didn't cite a particular Supreme Court case? Is he right?
Yeah, I mean, well, yes and no in the sense that no case has ever considered this kind of persistent area surveillance matched with a time machine, that is the ability, the constant recording and the ability to go back in time. That has never been considered. What has been considered are, you know, what a video camera sees as someone walks by, those kind of isolated incidents, and yes, it is true. The court has said what you do in public in general, you don't have a privacy interest in. But the court has also, in U.S. v. Jones, said that when the government is tracking your movements over a period of time, that is when you do have a privacy interest, and they have required a warrant supported by probable cause and individualized suspicion. And by definition, this technology doesn't do that. So this is a new thing, but the Fourth Amendment principles, I think, particularly the court's articulation of the privacy interests at stake in the GPS tracking case in U.S. v. Jones, support the notion that if the government is going to put an entire city under surveillance and have the ability to track each of us as we walk out of our door, that is a Fourth Amendment event. And I think is impermissible and should be impermissible.
Monty Real, I'd like to get back to the question I think T.J. Smith referred to, the low resolution of the images that these surveillance cameras put together. It's a very wide swath, more than 30 square miles. Tell us about what it is that is actually collected, and also kind of where the technology stands, whether we just are at a certain point or whether that's likely to change.
Well, the image that you see, it looks a lot like a Google Earth image that you can zoom in on. And if you imagine somebody standing on a street corner, when you zoom into the maximum resolution that you can get, that person looks like a dot. It's kind of a dark spot on the screen. You can't tell anything about the person from that image, but you can track them, and that's the point of this system. The point isn't to try to make individual identifications from the air, but it's to be able to track them to specific addresses. And you can track them, as we mentioned earlier, into the range of ground-based cameras. And by coupling it with that technology, you can get images of the face. But this particular technology itself won't give you that. It gives you a much broader swath, and the power of that image is just the scope. You can follow somebody for hours at a time within a very wide area, and that's what's new about the technology. And will the images get clearer? Will the cameras be improved? Probably. I wouldn't see any reason why the technology would stop. Ross McNutt makes the point that if that happens, his company will, instead of making the resolutions sharper, being able to zoom in closer onto individuals, he will make the area broader. So instead of 32 square miles, it would broaden to, say, 60. And, you know, we can just take his company's word for that. And I think one of the arguments that, you know, people make about this is other companies are probably going to get involved in this technology and offering similar systems. Will every company, you know, stand by that pledge?
We have just a couple minutes left, and I don't know whether, Monty, whether it's possible for you to answer John's question. He emailed us. Can you give an example of how this technology might be abused and explain how this is not something that can be controlled for?
Well, I mean, I can only kind of speculate scenarios in which it could be abused. But, you know, if you have an analyst, for example, that instead of responding to crimes, instead of, like, investigating something that's already happened, if a person were deciding to, you know, zoom in on a specific address of a friend, for example, there's nothing really stopping someone from doing that. This company says that it won't do it, and it says that it tracks its the movements of the analysts, so that if the analysts are looking at things different than crimes that are being called in, they can retroactively check that. But that's one example of something where the technology, you know, if no one was watching, if no one was monitoring those analysts or keeping track of them, they could, you know, look at basically anything within that 32-square-mile image, whether it was a crime or not.
Let me give this last minute to you, David Rocha of the ACLU. Do you see this as a technology that simply needs to be stopped cold, or is there a way to build in protections?
No, I don't think there's a way to build in protections. I think giving the government the power to track the movements of every resident of whatever jurisdiction we're talking about here, Baltimore, is to give government power that it simply shouldn't have. And tracking isn't even the right word. To give the government the power of having a permanent record of the movements of every person in the jurisdiction is simply a power that the government should not have.
And you wouldn't be, for example, comforted if they said, okay, we'll destroy the tapes after 30 days. That doesn't comfort you.
No, and I don't think... I think what you see over and over and over again with every kind of data that the government acquires, the impulse is always keep it forever. The cost of data storage only goes down. It doesn't go up. And whether we're talking about the automated license plate readers, whether we're talking about body cam data, whether no matter what data we're talking about, if the government has data and sees potential utility in it, they want to keep it forever. And that gives them the knowledge that it gives them is a danger to all of us.
I wish we had more time. There's lots more to talk about, but I'm very grateful to both of you for speaking with us. David Rocha, staff attorney of the ACLU of Maryland, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
And Monty Real, reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, who broke the story about persistent surveillance systems flying its sophisticated cameras over Baltimore. Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this story. The article is headlined, "It's Not Spying If They're Always Watching." We'll link to it from the midday page at WIPR.org. Baltimore Police spokesman T.J. Smith joined us earlier in the hour. I want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for midday guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. Features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes, on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow when we talk about affordable housing in the Baltimore region. We'll discuss the county's failure to pass a law to bar landlords from discriminating against tenants based on how they pay rent. And we'll talk about negotiations over low and moderate income housing requirements for Port Covington. I'm Sheila Kast. Have a great afternoon.